Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. How did you envision the future before the internet existed?
Imagine a world where every word ever written, every picture ever painted, and every film ever shot could be viewed instantly in your home via an information superhighway.
That would be the internet. This video is from 1994.
What that would mean is you could transform your home into a mammoth interactive entertainment centre, with the odd stock exchange and shopping centre thrown in. It sounds pretty grand.
It did sound pretty grand. And soon enough, we were happily clicking away online, ordering dinner, researching stuff, watching movies, connecting with long-lost friends. But we didn't imagine getting hundreds of emails and notifications in a day, feeling distracted by too much information all of the time, or seeing ads for things we Googled earlier. And we didn't sign up for having our Facebook posts be mined for unconscious biases or our fears. But that's what's happening. Cambridge Analytica gained access to the data of more than 50 million Facebook users and used that information to target people with super individualized political ads. Sometimes I can't help but feel like technology is a scary genie that's been let out of the bottle and it's taken control away from us. But then, it's also so amazing and helpful. We need it to function. On today's episode, we're going to explore those different sides of tech and the issue of control. Does tech control us? Do we control tech? We'll take a look at the role technology plays in our relationships, in medicine, even in deciding who goes to jail and who will be free. Our first story takes us to a casino. Inside, it's pretty dark, the booze is free and plentiful, there are no clocks around, so it's easy to forget how long you've been there, and of course, all of this is by design to keep you gambling longer. But there's more going on than that. The efforts to keep us playing and probably losing money have gone high tech, especially with slot machines, which researchers say are among the most addictive games out there. Liz Tung went to find out how this works.
In the movies, casinos are places of glamour and excitement. There are tense standoffs.
Yeah, I'm going to go all in because I don't think you got the space.
Suave card sharks.
Well, now I bring all sorts of pluses to the table.
And of course, adoring women.
You handle those cubes like a monkey handles coconuts.
Real life is a little different. I found that out on a recent visit to a Philadelphia casino called Sugar House. Inside, it's dim and smoky and actually kind of quiet, except for the slot machines. There's a whole sea of them as soon as you walk in. A lot of the people playing are older. I see a few with canes and one woman with tubes in her nose dragging an oxygen tank behind her. They look completely absorbed. I meet a guy named Sean who explains the appeal.
Well, I mean, I like the winning part of it. Everybody, you know, you like to win. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose.
Tonight, Sean's losing. He tells me he started with about $200. And now?
I'm down to, $67, and it ain't gave me nothing yet.
I watch him pull the lever again and again and again, and in 2 minutes flat, he's down to zero.
This was a bad day to play this machine.
According to gambling experts, every day is a bad day to play the slots. They say the machines are designed to trick people into playing longer and spending more than they would otherwise. That makes them one of the most lucrative games for casinos and one of the most dangerous for gamblers.
By far and away, the research shows that with slot machines, people get addicted quicker and their consequences are more severe.
Kevin Harrigan heads up the Gambling Research Lab at the University of Waterloo in Canada. He first got interested in the topic about 20 years ago.
My province of Ontario got 25,000 slot machines. And it intrigued me that these were games. They didn't seem that different than lots of other computer games, yet they were causing a lot of harm.
Reports of people losing their houses, committing suicide.
And it got me curious about what algorithms are behind these games that they would drive people to such states.
He wanted to know what was keeping people playing so long and so relentlessly that they were blowing their life savings, a dollar or two at a time.
I believe that I was being drugged. I mean, it was, you know, these machines were acting upon my brain like a drug would.
Sandra Adele is the author of a memoir called Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen. The book is about her four-year addiction to slot machines. It started when she was 61, a university professor on her first trip to the casino with a friend. It was supposed to just be a fun outing, but Sandra says she was disturbed by what she saw.
It was depressing to me, first of all, because there was a gloom to it. And all these people walking around smoking and just so focused on their machines.
She got an idea. She wanted to work on an investigative book about casinos and how they target vulnerable people. But there was something else on that first visit that drew her back. She played the slots and won big.
$1,100.
It sparked an urge in Sandra that she couldn't resist. And over the next few years, she got sucked further and further in. Soon she was drinking and taking advances out on her credit card. Things got bad. 4 years in, Sandra hit rock bottom when she was arrested one night for a DUI on her way to the casino. It prompted her to quit for good. But the whole experience left her with questions and anger.
How is it that someone who has no history of gambling becomes so quickly addicted to something that she doesn't like in a place she can't stand and then spirals down so quickly?
Kevin, the gambling studies researcher from Ontario, has been looking into cases like these. He says the answer starts in the 1980s, when slot machines first became computerized.
They got a lot more sophisticated, and the manufacturers could do all kinds of, if you like, sort of neat tricks to make the games more exciting, if you like, for the player.
There are two big ones that he and other researchers have looked into.
Okay, so the first one that we studied is commonly referred to as a near miss.
Which is when, for example, you get the first two cherries, and then you see a third one sliding down, but it just misses hitting the pay line. Sandra, the self-proclaimed slot machine queen, says she remembers the near misses well.
That's a tremendously potent motivation to stay there because you think the very next time it's going to win.
And Kevin says it's not Lady Luck who chooses when they drop.
Manufacturers program these near misses so that they happen more than they would by chance alone.
The other slot machine trick Kevin studied is called
losses disguised as wins.
This one takes a little more explanation. One of the advancements of modern, high-tech slot machines is that they let you make multiple bets. So on a single spin, you might lose a dollar and at the same time win 20 cents back on a smaller bet. In the end, you've still lost 80 cents, but the machine reacts as if you've just won some kind of jackpot. And as it turns out, so does your body. Kevin Harrigan's lab monitored players when they experienced near misses and losses disguised as wins. And what they found
is that players physiologically treat these as wins.
They may not think they're winning, but they feel like they're winning, which makes them want to play more. And that entire chain reaction starts in the brain. Gambling researcher Luke Clark and his team at the University of British Columbia have been using neural imaging scans to figure out what's happening in the brain that makes slot machines so addictive. Luke says near misses flood the brain's reward center with the chemical messenger dopamine.
Dopamine cells are really interested in uncertainty. You see much greater dopamine release to an unpredictable reward compared to the exact same reward if you knew that it was going to happen.
And nothing's more uncertain than gambling. People often play slot machines for hours at a time, and Luke says there's a theory that that sustained exposure could be changing the way the brain's dopamine system works. Recent research shows that slot machines can trigger a trance-like state in players. And Luke says, for slot machine gamblers, that state may actually be as much of a draw as the promise of winning.
They want to escape from the stresses, low mood, boredom, and slot machines kind of get them out of those troubles.
He says one way to break that trance could be using the same programming technology that's so good at grabbing gamblers' attention. Instead of enticing them with near misses, you might see a pop-up message warning you it's time to walk away.
Liz Tong reported this story. We're talking about tech and control today, who or what is in charge. So on one end, technology can be used to control our behavior in so many ways we don't even notice or understand, like at the slot machine. But on the opposite end of the tech spectrum, you have people like Christopher Henderson.
So I usually start the conversation off with, I haven't used the key to my house in 5 years. And that's when I get into, oh, there's geofencing on my phone that determines whether I'm home or not.
Chris has hooked up every part of his life with tech. He says it makes things easier. And I wanted to know, how exactly does he get into his house without a key?
Geofencing is putting up a virtual fence around a specific GPS coordinate. And when a device enters or exits that, basically a signal is given to an underlying system to notify whether it's present or not. So you can set up a lot of your automation based off of geofencing. So if someone arrives, so we should hear the door unlock and the lights come on and we can enter the house. I set my book bag down, and when I close the door, the walkway lights will go up.
There are motion sensors all over the hallways, so basically every room knows when he's coming in.
But as you can see as we go upstairs, so for example, like the bedroom, when you open the door, the light comes on.
The house also senses when he falls asleep.
So if you're occupying the bedroom and you fall asleep around 11 o'clock, it'll check the motion sensor logs to determine whether you've moved or not. If not, it'll start lowering the lights in the house. And then at 12 o'clock, if you still haven't moved, it turns everything off in the house. It's a very calming experience, just understanding that, you know, your house kind of like works with you. Just makes life easy.
Chris also collects data on everything, when he comes home or when he leaves, and he says that gives him more memory, literally.
For example, maybe someone asks me, hey, what time do you think you might be home on any given day? I have that data. Because I have that data, I can now provide a kind of like a screenshot of my life that day that I can sort of, you know, if I have pieces in my memory, I can tie it together with the data. And that is kind of like a live journal.
That's Christopher Henderson, a man clearly in charge of his technology. And that's what we're exploring today. Who is in charge when it comes to tech? Do we gain control through technology, or are we being controlled? Technology and the massive amounts of information we consume every day can have an impact on our brains and our ability to focus. Elizabeth Weingarten felt like she was losing the battle against distraction. She decided to try and find a way out of the technology wormhole. Here's her story.
When I was a kid, I'd curl up on our big white sofa and read for hours. When I got bored, I'd write a story, play in the backyard, or draw. My brain felt quiet, at ease, free to think long and hard. Fast forward to today. I'm living a life of digital distraction. At work, I feel like I'm inside a pinball machine. I ricochet from one task to another, never focusing on anything for longer than a minute. I'm constantly trying to be more productive. But even though I'm producing more, it feels like I'm thinking less.
Your brain has actually been hijacked.
Psychiatrist David Greenfield teaches at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine and started something called the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. Yep, that's a thing. Anyway, David told me I feel like I'm thinking less because I really am thinking less when I go online. Since I never know what I'm going to find when I open my laptop or check my phone, technology becomes a reward system, kind of like a slot machine. Each time I find something good, I get a hit of dopamine and activate certain areas of the brain.
Well, the reason why it's been hijacked is you've activated those pathways, but you've also done something else. When you activate those mesolimbic reward circuits, you shut down your thinking part of your brain, the frontal cortex.
Those reward circuits are linked to important survival behaviors. There's an evolutionary biological drive in charge.
So your brain thinks you should shut down your frontal lobes because you shouldn't have to think about eating and sex because you need to just do it because that's what survival is linked to.
Good for the survival of the human race, bad for me staying off Instagram. As an experiment, I decided I wanted to take control of my brain back, to be able to read more than 3 pages of a book in a sitting and think more creatively. At first, I tried using an app that measured my screen time each day, but I ignored its alerts to put my phone away. They always came at the wrong time. And then I tried meditation. That got me into a Zen state of mind, but when I stopped meditating, I was back to my old habits. I still needed some concrete strategies to get my brain back in shape long term. So I turned to the experts for help. Like Adam Ghazali, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco. He has a lab called Neuroscape that uses technology to help people improve their ability to focus and pay attention.
And the way I approach it is to baby step into it, like all new habit formation of essentially setting some time aside that you're going to make the decision to shut down all your other information sources, your email, your phone, your social media, and focus.
As I spoke with Adam, I started keeping an audio diary to log how well his theory translates to my practice. First, I tried exactly what he suggested, setting aside some time to shut down all of my information sources and only do one thing.
Usually I have three different email accounts open, and then I have various articles that I've kind of half started reading. I was listening to a podcast earlier. I have my calendar open. Anyway, it's kind of a mess. But now I am going through, I'm closing all of these tabs. It feels very painful.
But the longer I sat with the discomfort and the more days I tried it, the easier it became. I thought I might be able to make it even easier by introducing what behavioral scientists call a hassle factor into my technology use. So one time when I wanted to stay off my phone, I put it deep into my backpack just as I was about to get on a 45-minute train ride.
And this is a time when I would normally be on my phone probably the whole time, but I'm going to try to put it someplace where it's really hard to reach.
Well, I just got off the train, and I have to say it wasn't too bad. The first few minutes I was pretty fidgety and didn't know if I was going to survive, but I did, and I got to hear a woman talk about all of the antioxidant powers of garlic, and basically I eavesdrop a lot more when I'm not on my phone. So that's creepy.
It felt like I was improving, but even after a few weeks of practice, it was still hard for me to focus on a book at night.
It's a really good book. It's a novel, but I feel this kind of like anxiety almost as I'm reading it, I need to check something on my phone. I keep getting flashbacks of the work emails that I need to respond to, the people that I need to call.
I was pitying myself and my weakling brain when I remembered an insight from my brain coach, Adam.
A lot of it is becoming introspective of your own thoughts, you know, this sort of meta-awareness of how you're engaging in the world and when you are allowing yourself to drift into behaviors that you find unhealthy or that you believe to be unhealthy.
My slips in attention and that itch to grab my phone weren't necessarily bad, just a reminder that what I was attempting is pretty hard. Getting into mental shape isn't easy. For me, what this whole brain experiment boiled down to was awareness. Now, before I pick up my phone or check social media, I focus. And I ask myself, am I doing it because I'm bored, stressed, or tired? Or do I genuinely need some information? Most of the time, I put the phone away without much struggle. Now, I can appreciate the calm inside my head. Just like when I was a kid, I enjoy the quiet and all of the things that can come from it.
That was Elizabeth Weingarten reporting, and a version of her story was published in The Behavioral Scientist. Lots of us feel out of control when it comes to the use of technology. And then, if you're a parent, you also have to monitor the tech use of your kids, especially teenagers. So much of their lives happen on social media, it's almost like their phones are an extension of their bodies. But it turns out some teenagers are choosing to take breaks. Jessica Korkunis has more.
I've been wondering whether some teens have had enough and whether they've started to pull back or opt out completely from using social media. So I reached out to Finn Carer, a 17-year-old I've known since she was little. What I've noticed about Finn is she hardly ever has her phone out.
I try not to go on it a lot. Like, I can go for periods of time and, like, leave my phone at home and not be on my phone. I've gone to sleepaway camp and not had my phone for, like, a month. And I was like, this is great.
I met up with Finn one afternoon at her row home, along with her friend Maxine Van Osten. They're now classmates at a Catholic high school. Finn had changed into street clothes, and Maxine was still wearing her school uniform. They met when they were little, around the year the first iPhones hit the shelves.
2007, I was only 7, but I remember my mom having like a flip phone.
For teens, Snapchat is one of the most popular apps. It's where a lot of kids do this thing called streaks.
Do you know what a streak is? Okay, it's basically where on Snapchat you have like a number next to the person's name of how many days you've Snapchatted consecutively. And if you do miss a day, you lose the streak. People get up to like 300 and stuff, and I'm like, that's crazy.
I remember when I started, I had like a lot of, like 10 streaks probably, and I was like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore because it's addicting. It's like every day I have to be on my phone.
I told her that she shouldn't have streaks anymore because you wake up and you Snapchat this person. It's literally a photo, maybe like of a black screen that says streaks. And it's like, what's the point? It's not a conversation. Mm-hmm. There's like no point.
I had a lot of like streaks with people I didn't know.
Yeah.
Barely knew. Like I knew from school and we were just like, oh, streaks? Sure. I'm like, but I don't even like you. Like some of these people I didn't exactly enjoy talking to.
See,
so
there's no point.
With Finn's encouragement, Maxine now feels relieved to have stopped doing them, except...
People got mad at me because I was like, okay, this is the end of my streaks. I'm not doing streaks anymore. And it feels nice. It's like cleansing. Like, you're not chained to having to wake up every morning and take a picture of whatever to send to everybody. And it's, like, really freeing. So thank you for that.
See?
Maxine says Finn has been a good influence on her, helping her break free from some of her phone habits.
I used to be, like, crazy about it, posting, like, oh, I'm going to blah, blah, blah with my basketball shoes on or whatever, you know? And, like, talking to Finn, she, like, I don't know, just made me feel like I don't need everyone to know exactly what I'm doing all the time. It was such a relief.
Let's be real, though. She still goes on her phone a lot.
I do, but not as much.
Yeah. That's true, but still, she does go on her phone a lot.
Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat and all of these platforms still remain this really important place for young people to connect with other people.
That's Amanda Lenhart of the Better Life Lab at New America, a nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. Last year, Lenhart led a poll that found 58% of American teens, like Maxine, have started to put their phones down more often.
That 58% is all kinds of breaks. It's both voluntary and involuntary. And so it's about 2/3 of that group that have taken a voluntary break of some kind where they themselves said, hey, I'm taking myself off of this platform. And often those teens find those breaks to be positive experiences.
The poll surveyed 790 teenagers between the ages of 13 and 17. The researchers uncovered some of the reasons why teens are taking social media breaks.
They're taking them because they are concerned about too much drama. They're concerned because there's other things that they feel like they need to be doing and that social media is taking away from that. Some teens talk about feeling overloaded by information and not being able to manage all the information that's coming to them through social media.
I got to know another 17-year-old, Sophia Delgado. She has a job working as a teen leader at an after-school program. When she started working, she decided to quit social media altogether.
I decided to just really focus on myself, like focus on actually being present in life and not just on the phone the whole time.
She felt like she was being judged and judging herself.
A lot of the stress that I was putting on myself, like insecurities about myself, saying, oh my God, this girl's so much prettier than me. Oh my God, like she's like this, she's like that. And like, I found myself, I don't have to do that anymore. Like, I can just be me and accept me for who I am. Like, screw what social media or society thinks about who I am. Like, I felt that relief. Like, I was just doing me. Like, I was being happy the way I know how to be happy. I'm just so eager to just, like, meet with people and talk to people rather than sending them a message. Like, I'm just more open. I feel like more outgoing. Like, I'm just so ready to start a conversation with anyone.
But having those conversations with her friends isn't easy when they're hanging out and everyone's on their phones.
I hate it. To know that they're all sitting on their phones, I feel like they're already in a mindset where that's all there is to do.
This story was reported by Jessica Korkunis. You can hear a longer version on the podcast Dial Back, which explores the impact of technology on our lives. We're talking about tech and control. Are we controlling tech? Is tech controlling us? Technology and big data are used all the time to help us make decisions. Algorithms help predict which movies we might like, how we might behave in a certain situation, or how much we'll end up paying for our car insurance. Increasingly, algorithms also play a role in courtrooms across the country, in deciding the length of sentences, whether you should spend months behind bars or walk free until your trial. That's happening in New Jersey. Joe Hernandez covers the state for WHYY, and he's been looking into this issue. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Mikan.
So what is this algorithm being used in New Jersey courts, and how does it work?
So it's called the Pre-Trial Risk Assessment, or the PSA. And it came on the scene last year after New Jersey basically scrapped cash bail and switched to a system that says before a criminal trial, defendants will either be confined to jail or let go.
Why did they get rid of cash bail?
Well, the thinking was that it was unfair that a lot of people couldn't afford their bail and would spend months in jail before their trial, where they could eventually be found not guilty of the crime anyway. So instead of setting bail at a certain amount, judges now have to decide if you're in or you're out until your trial. So the state said, okay, let's use this computer algorithm to help judges make those decisions and evaluate defendants.
So what does the algorithm actually take into account?
Right. So it takes into account things like your age, current charges, previous convictions. It crunches those things together in a database with thousands of other cases, and then it gives you two scores. One says, if we let you go, how likely are you to commit a crime while you're out on release? And the other says, if we let you go, how likely are you to show up for a future court date? Now, judges don't have to rule based on these scores, but they're meant to be used as a guide.
Is the idea that the algorithm is better at this?
Yeah. I mean, these computers have hundreds of thousands of cases that they study, reams of data, and they're able to see patterns that regular humans like us aren't able to detect. I talked to UPenn criminologist Richard Burke about this. He says it's proven that algorithms help eliminate biases that we all have, and they're just better at making predictions.
That's been demonstrated since the 1980s. What they compare is clinical judgments, people sitting around a table, no matter what their expertise, against even very simple statistical tools. And in cognitive psychology, it's well known that the simple statistical tools are outperform humans.
I can see that, but I have to say that I would probably feel still more comfortable being assessed and judged by a human, right? Because what if the algorithm gets it wrong and just doesn't get me?
Right. I mean, that is the huge question in New Jersey right now, is what happens when the algorithm gets it wrong? Because on the one hand, the algorithm could recommend putting somebody in jail who really should be allowed to return to their family pending trial. On the other hand, the algorithm could release somebody or recommend releasing somebody who's an actual danger to the community. So I want to tell you the story of Christian Rogers. He was from South Jersey, an artist, a father of two, and a rapper known as Chris Fetty. I talked to his mom, June Rogers, who lives in a town called Millville. She said last spring, Christian and some of his friends got into this small argument with another guy in town over a music video. Threats were made, but then...
April 5th of 2017, the guy's name was Jules Black. He was arrested on gun charges by a state trooper. Well, he had been previously threatening my son and a couple other our family members and things. So by him getting arrested April 5th, my son thought that he would be in jail for a little while.
But a day later, Jules Black gets released.
Do you understand those rights?
Yes.
You do want to have an attorney represent you, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And was he released because of this algorithm?
Well, we know he was scored by the algorithm because everybody who's arrested for a crime in New Jersey is now, but we don't know what his score was because mm-hmm. that's not public information. But the scores must have been low enough that the prosecutor in the case didn't ask the court to keep Jules Black behind bars. And because of the way the law is written, if the prosecutor doesn't ask the judge to detain a defendant, the judge has to let that person go.
So you're going to be released. Now we got to talk about what you're going to do while you're out on the street.
Okay, so that was April 6th. 3 days later, Chris Rogers is out running an errand when Jules Black allegedly drives by and spots Chris.
Well, he sees my son coming from this store. And the story is that he's driving along and he sees Chris walking. He rolls down the window. He pulls out a gun and he shoots my son in the chest a couple of times. And my son takes off running. He's driving down the street, firing at my child as he's running for his life. My son ducks through an alley and he collapses in a backyard of an empty house. Well, someone called the police saying that there were shots fired or whatever. And then when the police arrived, they followed my son's blood trails to find him laying back there.
So what has happened since then?
Well, Jules Black is in jail now. He was charged with Chris's murder and he's pleading not guilty. And I'd never heard back from the public defender who's representing him. June Rogers, obviously, was reeling from this, and she's channeled a lot of that pain into figuring out what happened. And now she's blaming the algorithm and the new system in New Jersey for her son's death. I should add that the state updated the algorithm after this so that people facing gun charges, which is what Jules Black was initially arrested on, would get an automatic recommendation of detention. But that was after the fact, obviously.
So what is she doing?
Well, she's become something of an activist against this algorithm and this new system.
And I'm going around and I'm speaking out against it to these lawmakers and these people that are making these decisions saying, hey, we're going to use this. We're going to implement this system. All I can do is warn them that it's not what they're making it out to be. This is a very, very dangerous tool. Let's stop this before we start losing more lives.
But here's the flip side. Proponents of scrapping cash bail and using this algorithm say people like Jules Black could have simply paid their bail and gotten out of jail just as quickly in the past. And Black did, in fact, do that in years prior. He went to jail, bailed out, and then committed new crimes.
And aside from this terrible story, Joe, what do we know about if this algorithm is working or not, or how well it works?
Well, we don't know a lot about how well it's been working in New Jersey yet. What we do know is that the jail population in the state dropped about 20%, so advocates say that means fewer poor people are stuck behind bars waiting for their trials, and they say that that's good. But the state hasn't released data yet on defendants who are released and then go commit new crimes, or defendants who are released and then skip court later. Those public officials are standing by the algorithm and say the ultimate decision here is still up to the judge. I spoke with Judge Glenn Grant. He's the acting administrative director of the New Jersey courts.
Well, we clearly envision that the tool, the PSA, is just that, a tool. We never intended this to be an automatic substantiation of the recommendation. We are continuing the criminal justice process that has existed in this country for centuries. That is, judges are the most knowledgeable, the most trained, and they are the ones that we expect to make this difficult decision as to whether someone should be held in jail until their case is resolved.
But of course, we know even judges make mistakes. They're people too. And this is something that Penn criminologist Richard Burke really emphasized when I spoke to him. He said, if you want something that's fair, if you want something that's unbiased and transparent, get a computer. You can see what's inside a computer. You know how it comes to the conclusions it reaches. You can't do that with a person. You can't look inside a judge's mind.
And for now, Joe, this algorithm is here to stay.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mikan.
Yeah. In healthcare, technology is pretty much part of everything. From the actual devices used to take our vital signs or administer medicine, to medical records and billing. And that tech is constantly changing. But Alana Gordon has this story about an old piece of technology that perhaps surprisingly has stuck around.
Doctors have a history of making technology work for them.
The first telephone switchboard was rolled out at Yale in the late 19th century, and it was actually praised for its ability to connect medical schools and the infirmary.
That is Nate Gross, a doctor and co-founder of a big online physician network called Doximity. He says fast forward to the mid-20th century, when another advancement entered medicine. The pager.
And the subsequent communication revolution it enabled in healthcare.
Where's the doctor? Page him. Nowadays, these clunky, rectangular things might seem all but obsolete with the internet and smartphones and all, but they are still everywhere in hospitals.
Today, there are only a few million pagers left in the world, and medicine is their last stronghold.
So yeah, I remember on the first day of residency, like during the orientation in 2015, they started handing us all pagers. And I was like, is this a joke?
That is Pulse contributor Avir Mitra, a medical resident in New York.
But it actually turned out not to be a joke. We were all actually getting pagers.
What a beautiful sound, right?
Physicians like Allison Bond, a hospitalist at Mass General in Boston, have a sort of love-hate relationship with them.
When I get a page, sometimes my palms will get sweaty and I just have this feeling of dread of like, oh God, what is this? There are certain time periods, just given the way that shifts work out and things like that, that you'll get what we call hammer paged, which is where you get a lot of pages in a short period of time, and that can be really frustrating and really tiring. It's really demanding, yeah.
But I love it when it's not going off.
The pager, says Anupam Jena, is an important symbol in medicine. He's a doctor at Mass General, too.
So I was first introduced to the pager in 2005 when I was a third-year medical student in Chicago. And at that time, getting a pager was every medical student's dream because it was your first step to thinking that you were a doctor. And, you know, in hindsight, the reason why I love the pager so much is that I felt like it made me look cool. But I wasn't important enough to actually get paged. Then fast forward about 2-3 years later, I'm an intern in Boston, and I would say that I would get paged probably 100 times per day. I could tell you that the sound of a pager at 2 a.m. at night is one of the worst sounds you'll hear.
There's a reason pagers have stuck around.
And I think the next one is a code pager.
They can be hard to ignore.
You know, somebody needs CPR and it's very serious.
But why pagers? Why not phones? Allison, the other doctor at Mass General, has written about this.
Technologically, pagers continue to be, as far as I know, more reliable than cell phone technologies.
She says her hospital does use text messages for some non-urgent stuff, but
if you're in some of the like older buildings, which a lot of American hospitals are, especially in the basement and things like that, I just do not get cell phone reception, but the pager signal has no trouble getting through there.
They're also really durable.
A pager, if you drop it, really nothing happens. We joke about dropping it really, really hard to see if something would happen. But you only have to really switch the batteries out every couple weeks, usually. You don't have to charge it every night. And so you can imagine, like, if someone's forgotten to charge that cell phone, that could be potentially a disaster. So the pager is, I think, probably going to be here to stay. Maybe I'll eat my words in a couple decades, but I don't see a time when we don't have them at all.
Alana Gordon reported this story.
What a beautiful sound, right?
Maybe Maybe doctors can't get rid of their pagers just yet, but advances in technology could transform how medicine is done, giving doctors and patients more control.
The world 5 to 10 years from now will be one in which people will find it to have been odd that you took a half a day off from work to go for a 12-minute visit to the doctor's office.
That's Bob Wachter. He is the chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and he writes a lot about doctors and technology. Bob says soon medicine will come to us, especially for people with chronic illnesses like diabetes, who usually have to go see their doctors frequently for basic checkups. Instead, he says that kind of care will happen right in their homes thanks to technology.
So in a world not too far away, a patient like that, a patient with diabetes, will wake up in the morning, stick his or her finger, and probably by then not even stick their finger, put a sensor on, see how their sugar's doing. It will all go into some artificial intelligence engine that will then say to the patient, it looks like you're doing great, or it looks like your sugar's a little high. I recommend that you increase your insulin by 2 units. It will connect to the healthcare system, but it's got to connect in a new way. Because if I'm a primary care doctor who has 1,500 or 2,000 patients that I'm following, and all 2,000 now have digitally enabled home lives, and my system for managing the patient who's not doing very well is that data goes to that primary care doctor. For all 2,000 patients, you can imagine that primary care doctor quitting tomorrow. So there needs to be a new layer built that hasn't been built yet, and I call that person a care traffic controller, analogous to an air traffic controller. But you can imagine someone sitting in front of a screen that shows 500 diabetic patients being cared for in a given healthcare system. And it looks today like patient 27, 39, and 112 are having a bad day. And it looks like the artificial intelligence has given them some advice, but they're still not doing well. What am I going to do? I'm going to press a button and we're going to have a video chat with that patient. And who's that person? Probably some combination of a nurse practitioner with some advanced technology expertise. We're going to have a video chat and see how you're doing. And then at the end of that conversation, I may say, you know what, you actually need to talk to the doctor. That's probably going to be a video conversation. But if things really aren't going well, maybe you actually come in and see the doctor, assuming the doctor still has an office. So that's a very different way of thinking about the healthcare world in the future. And I don't see that as fantasy anymore. I see that as being the system within 5 or 10 years.
Bob Wachter is a physician, and he's written a book about how tech is changing healthcare. It's called The Digital Doctor: Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. We're talking about technology and control. We don't usually think of older people as being very tech-savvy, but there's one technology that's taking off in the 70-plus crowd, voice-activated personal assistant, like, you know, Google Home or Amazon Alexa. Carrie Olson is president of the Front Porch Center for Innovation and Well-Being. That's an organization that looks into how technology impacts the lives of older people. And she did some research putting Alexa devices into homes in a retirement community just outside of San Diego. And she says Alexa made it easier for people to get online.
Challenges such as mobility, tremors, vision, eyesight, hearing, all those things can kind of make computer use with a keyboard very cumbersome.
Carrie says the more they personalized Alexa's settings, the more helpful it was for people. She saw a big impact when they added smart devices to people's houses.
We had one example of a couple where the wife is in a wheelchair and the husband is a caregiver. And the husband said, I've been setting the thermostat and changing it for years for her, and now she can do it herself. And that's so empowering.
Alexa fills other roles in the lives of seniors, too. Abby Holtzman has this story.
Cecilia, or Seal, Banks has been living alone for almost 30 years, since her husband passed away. She's got amazing posture, her makeup is always impeccable, and she doesn't see herself as frail.
Okay, I'm 92, going to be 93. Now, don't faint, because everybody faints when I say that.
Seal gave me a tour of her apartment.
You have such beautiful pictures. Who are the people in these pictures?
That's my daughter and my son, who both have passed away. And that's my grandson when he was small, and today he's a big, gorgeous hunk, and I adore him. And that's my gorgeous husband. My gorgeous husband was my gorgeous husband.
Seal doesn't have much family left, and her handsome grandson lives all the way out in Texas. So Amazon Alexa keeps Seal company.
I use her every day. I talk to her. She talks to me. She's a lot of fun. I want to know what the weather is. Fills me right in. Then I know how to dress. Alexa, what is the weather today?
There's a high wind warning in effect Friday, March 2nd, 11 a.m. to Saturday, March 3rd.
I do ask for a lot of music. Yeah, I like music. Alexa, will you play for me any Benny Goodman song?
Shuffling Songs by Benny Goodman.
He's a wonderful player for people who like to dance. And I love to dance, and my husband used to like to dance. She's good company. You know, if I just, it's too quiet here, I'll start a conversation. Alexa, how is your day today?
I'm good. Ready to help.
You're always a good helper, Alexa. I really appreciate that. You want to have dinner with me tonight?
No answer from Alexa, but suddenly out of the blue, she does jump in with a music suggestion. Goodbye, Norma Jean. No,
I never knew you at all. You had the grace. Isn't that amazing that she came over and asked me? Oh, I'm hysterical. That's so great. Yeah, we're very good friends, Lex and I. Very good friends, yeah. See, I don't even have to ask her for anything. Yeah. I don't think she does that with everybody. And it seems to me you lived
your life like a candle in the wind. Our intern, Abby Holtzman, reported this story. Our other intern is Elizabeth Estrada. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Some of us live for the future, but what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org.